Welcome to On Deadline, your radio news from Odyssey newsrooms across the country. I'm Christy Strausser, Odyssey's managing editor of news. Let's kick things off with the latest in Iran. Remember the days, a few weeks ago, when most of us didn't know anything about the Strait of Hormuz? Yeah, those days are over. Here's Tommy Tucker at WWL in New Orleans.
Joined by Lindsay Cohn, our friend who is the visiting associate at Columbia School of International and Public Affairs. Tell me the latest on the Iran war, as far as we know.
Well, the very latest is that we don't know what's going on. This is really fascinating. There are dueling reports coming out of Iran and the United States talking about what. So the United States Navy Central Command is claiming that two U.S. destroyers have passed through the strait into the Persian or Arabian Gulf. The BBC is reporting that they can't find those vessels on marine traffic, which indicates either that they haven't gone through or that they've turned off their responders. Iran says that they haven't come in, and Iran says that they hit a U.S. destroyer with two missiles. CENTCOM denies this. Iran claims that the vessel that it hit had turned off its transponder, and then when it turned it back on, they found it and hit it. Like, no one... And there is no confirmation of any of this. We just have both sides making claims and denying claims, and the news media are scrambling to try and figure out what's happening. So there's a lot of uncertainty right now.
I hope nobody views this as anti-Trump, because I don't mean it anti-Trump in any way at all. But it seems to me, from what I do know, is... Let me make an analogy. You know, I remember years ago being watching a movie at nighttime, and the lights were out, and one little mosquito was terrifying me because it just kept biting me over and over, and I couldn't find it. And it just seems like in this case that the United States is me sitting there watching TV, and Iran is a mosquito, not terrifying necessarily, but just annoying the heck out of everything and ruining the experience. Iran shouldn't be our equal to begin with, but yet it seems somehow as though that they've become our equal in this war. Is that accurate or not?
Well, Tommy, what you're describing is that Iran is not the equal of the United States in terms of conventional power, either navy or land or air, none of those things. But that in those circumstances, that's when you go to asymmetric means, right? If you can't match someone symmetrically, which they absolutely cannot, that's when you turn to asymmetric means. And so that's one of the things that Iran has been doing. But the second point here is that we are operating in their territory, which puts us at a distinct disadvantage, even with our conventional superiority. It is just so much easier for them to do these little things. And again, we have absolutely no confirmation that they did, in fact, hit a U.S. vessel. The U.S. has denied it, and there hasn't been any independent news confirmation of that. But they can do so many things that it's just very, very difficult to defend against, because they're using, you know, very small ships, boats that are hard to detect, rockets and missiles coming from places that we haven't been able to find yet and destroy. So it's just, we are at somewhat of a geographical disadvantage here as well.
It seems like maybe that we have a 50 caliber machine gun out to kill a mosquito, where if we hit it, boy, we're gonna decimate it. But the problem is hitting it. Meanwhile, you're wasting a lot of resources trying to get this little mosquito. Am I underestimating Iran too much here, Lindsay?
I mean, I wouldn't call it a mosquito, Tommy. Right? They are currently blocking up one of the most important maritime straits in the world, again, which they can do purely because of geography and because of their weaponry. So they are causing real damage and distress to the global economy. The problem that the United States has is that getting them to a point where they can't do that anymore, where they physically can't do that anymore, is almost impossible. So the other option is to get them to agree to stop doing it. And to get them to agree to stop doing that requires some kind of compromise, right? And currently the Trump administration does not seem interested in compromise. They are looking for maximalist demands. And the Iranians have decided that they can hold out against that at least a little bit longer.
So tell me about Iran holding out, because somebody texted in, the blockade is hurting them, and indeed it is. But my question about that is, who is it hurting? Because if you got the people in the streets that are protesting. Well, the Iranians, you know, they've already, what's the guard of the Internet Revolutionary Guard? What's it?
The Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, yes.
They've killed God knows how many Iranians in the street already. So these people are already weakened and have no, I don't think they want to fight anymore. But I just wonder about the quality of life, and that quality of life is suffering. I wonder about the quality of life of the IRG, and if their quality of life is not really changing, then what's their hurry to get this thing moving along? Am I missing something?
No, you're describing sort of the logic of sanctions and blockades quite well. In this particular case, you know, the U.S., the president has stated a couple of times that he was hoping that the people would rise up and overthrow the regime. You and I have talked about this. I said that that was very unlikely. Most, I think, experts on Iran think that's very unlikely. But
wait, let me stop for one second, Lindsay. When you say unlikely, is it even possible? How could that happen? Because when they tried to protest, they were literally mowed down in the streets, were they not?
Yes. I mean, it is possible to overthrow a regime eventually if it's weakened enough. But no, as you're absolutely right. The likelihood of a popular uprising successfully overthrowing this regime is extremely low. It would have to involve a total collapse of the IRGC, and that is very unlikely to happen. The other thing this blockade can do, though, and you kind of alluded to this, is it can deprive the regime of income. And if the regime doesn't have income, then it can't buy things for itself, including military hardware, but also food and things like that. So part of the purpose of the blockade is to try to reduce the regime's ability to keep fighting, kind of the same way that the sanctions on Russia were meant to affect the Russian ability to keep fighting in Ukraine. But, you know, as we, that is a long, slow process. That is not the kind of thing that changes behavior overnight.
So, again, it would seem as though... Let me phrase it this way, Lindsay. We were going full guns, pardon the pun, right? I mean, man, we were bombing this and bombing that and everything, advantage USA, advantage USA. Then all of a sudden it came to a screeching halt. And that happened because of the blockade. It happened because of the ceasefire. I'm trying to remember this chronologically and put it together logically as to what happened.
Well, you know, not having been inside the room when the president made the decision to observe the ceasefire, I can't tell you exactly what was in his mind. But what we had come to is what is known in military terms as sort of a hurting stalemate, when neither side seems to be able to make a lot of advance or improvement, but both of them are really suffering. And so that's the kind of situation when you can kind of get a ceasefire agreement. And I think Iran is taking... I mean, both sides are taking advantage of that ceasefire agreement. The bombing was really, really hurting the world economy. So, but once the ceasefire was in place, that's when the blockade went in. The blockade didn't come first. But yeah, the difficulty here is that the president, I believe, thought that this was going to be quick and easy and did not have much of a plan for how to deal with something prolonged and much more difficult. And so when it wasn't quick and easy, when the regime didn't collapse, when they didn't give in right away because we had bombed them so significantly and taken out most of their military capability, when they didn't come immediately to the table and say, yes, we'll do whatever you want, I think the U.S. didn't really have a whole lot of plans in place for what to do next. And that's kind of why we're trying different things to see if we can get them to agree to our demands. And it has not worked yet.
Generally speaking, you game all of this out beforehand, right? If this, then that. If that, then this.
Normally, yes, but that doesn't mean that you game it correctly, right? I mean, I think that, so for example, one of the things that we... that has been reported multiple times is that the president did not credit the idea that the Iranians would close the Strait of Hormuz, right? So the assumptions that you make when you game this out really drive how you then do it. And the fact that there were some people saying, what if they close the Strait of Hormuz? What do we do then? If the president's response is, I don't think they'll do that, then you don't necessarily have a plan in place if they do.
So what happens from here?
I think what happens from here is there.
Who can outlast whom, I guess, is the question, right?
That is the question, and right now, nobody knows. Right. This is the point where one of the things we talk about is that the battle is part of the bargaining, right? At this point, the reason that we can't reach an agreement is because the two sides do not agree on who is going to win this fight. They both think they can win. And as long as they both think they can win, they will not reach any kind of compromise. And so we're just going to keep going until they both agree on who is winning. And I don't know what the answer to that is. I think that they are going to keep talking. We may get closer to some kind of agreement to reopen the strait. The Iranian proposal is that we reach an agreement to reopen the strait and then talk about the nuclear program. So far, President Trump has rejected that and said that the only time we're going to open the strait is if we've negotiated on the nuclear program. So that's a standoff. But, you know, as time goes on and costs mount on both sides and on everyone else's side, because it's hurting the entire world, the bargaining positions may soften.
This is costing a ton of money, is it not?
Yes.
United States, Iran, world with the oil market, etc.
Yes, and not just the oil market. So, you know, I'm sure that you've talked to your listeners about the fact that a lot of other stuff is being held up, especially fertilizer.
Oh, yeah.
And things like that, there are parts of the world right now where fuel is already being rationed. There are parts of the world that are already looking at food crises. The developing world is getting hit much harder than the United States is. And so when we in the U.S. are feeling it, we have to recognize that the rest of the world is feeling it way, way harder. And they will try to exert diplomatic pressure.
Do you think we're moving toward resolution at all?
Yes, I think we have to be moving toward resolution. This is, again, as I said, because costs are building up, the more costs build up, at some point, someone is going to decide that it's not worth it to hold out anymore. Now, who that's going to be first, I have no idea. But at some point, someone's going to soften their bargaining position and begin to accept compromise. What we will do in the meantime is the problem.
But how long can the U.S. fight a war without congressional approval? Here's KCBS in San Francisco.
The 60th day of Operation Epic Fury in Iran has come and gone. That deadline is significant because the War Powers Resolution means that a U.S. president is supposed to either get congressional approval for continued military action or withdraw. So what's happening with that deadline? For Bruce Fine, a lawyer specializing in Constitution, international civil rights and government, regulatory law. And Professor Fine, let's first of all just orient everyone. What is the War Powers Resolution? It was passed after Vietnam. What does it say?
Well, I think you need to go back and first understand what the Constitution says, because the statute cannot undermine the Constitution. It was universally understood at the Constitutional Convention, from James Madison to George Washington to Alexander Hamilton, Thomas Jefferson et al., that Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11 says only Congress can take us from a state of peace to a state of war. You cannot have a statute that undermines that mandate. So we had initially the understanding that Congress has not authorized any war against Iran. Mr. Trump is not responding in self-defense to an attack by Iran on the United States. So the whole exercise is flagrantly unconstitutional, and Congress cannot authorize unconstitutional action by abdication. The second thing, it's clearly a criminal war of aggression. The United States, with other allies after World War II, established the Nuremberg Tribunal, and its charter in Section 6 made it criminal to engage in wars not in self-defense. Indeed, there are eight Nazi leaders, including Hermann Göring, who were sentenced to death because the Third Reich was attacking Poland. They were attacking Denmark, Norway, France, Dutch, the Belgians, without any justification. And therefore, that made under international law, which is incorporated in U.S. law by Congress, a crime of aggression, which is, in fact, what is occurring in Iran at present. And 60 days has nothing to do with curing that crime of aggression. I want to underscore, I believe that the mullahs in Iran are despicable people. They were as despicable as the government they replaced, namely the Shah, who had the Savak trained by the CIA to replicate the Gestapo. But we're the ones who brought in the Shah when we overthrew Prime Minister Mossadegh in 1953. But putting that aside, the War Powers Resolution 1, it was passed over President Nixon's veto. It is, in many respects, it's kind of incomprehensible. I was there at the time when the resolution was passed, because Section 8 says that nothing is supposed to change the Constitution's allocation of war powers. And moreover, it says that in the only three conditions justify President on his own using the military in a situation where our forces are endangered. None of them include a 60-day window to just go fight and start anywhere you want for 60 days. And if you ask, maybe we'll give you an extra 30. Yeah. I think what really, it's a little bit convoluted. The 60-day period means that in a case like Pearl Harbor, where the president can respond because we're actually at war, because we're a victim of some other party's aggression, he can fight a defensive war.
Right.
For 60 days, and then has to get out of it.
President Trump is not the first president to use U.S. troops without effective Congress, but what he's trying to do here is to say there's a ceasefire, and so that 60-day clock, whether you agree with it or not, no longer applies, or the clock has stopped. Is there anything legally to back that up beyond what the president and Secretary Hegseth are saying?
Nothing. Moreover, you can't even define what is the ceasefire. For 1 minute, 10 minutes, 11 minutes? What does it mean? We have a ceasefire in Gaza. We have a ceasefire in Lebanon. Everyone's being killed anyway. And there's no definition of ceasefire in the War Powers Resolution. And you can see if that were true, you can manipulate the whole thing. You can say, well, the only time when there's not a ceasefire is when there's actual someone is killed, but every place else is downtime. It's an absurd argument and will not have any day to anyone who has reason. Now, typically, the U.S. courts stay out of these kinds of legal disputes under political questions, doctrine or otherwise. We're unlikely to get a judicial decision on this matter. It'll really be up to the American people in Congress. But that interpretation is, on its face, absurd.
Higher prices for gas and farming and transportation. And as Americans tighten their belts, Tommy Tucker at WWL in New Orleans wonders, has tipping gotten out of control?
I'm Mr. Manners, Thomas Farley, an etiquette expert and columnist. Good morning, sir. I don't like being put in the position of supervising and managing the wait staff, because I feel like when you make me responsible for paying them and rewarding who gets a raise and who doesn't, that's what you're doing. To me, I would much rather have it, look, you supervise the staff, the people that are good you keep, the ones that are not so good you don't keep, and then you pay them the fair wage, but I guess that way the restaurant owners would have to put up the money and not me, right? But I would rather have them charge it to add it to the price of the food. Take me through all of that, Thomas.
Yeah. Yes, and Tommy, so you would not be alone on this. So the way we have operated as a country when it comes to hospitality in a restaurant for decades now is that servers in restaurants, they are paid what's called a tipped minimum wage. That means that their employer is responsible for a very small percentage of their earnings, and the balance of the bulk of their compensation comes from gratuities from customers. Now, that is something that most servers are loath to change, believe it or not. The system that you're proposing, where there would be effectively a one flat compensation paid for by the employer, the servers don't like that concept because they can typically make a whole lot more when they're being tipped by customers than when they're being paid a flat wage by their employers. The employers don't like switching over to that system because what they find is, and simply raising prices to compensate for the higher wages, they find that customers tend to stay away. So you might be lured to a restaurant by their $29.99 steak special that they might be running that week. But if that $29.99 special suddenly becomes a $40 special because the restaurant owner is building in the extra costs and then saying, don't worry about tipping, that's covered, customers tend to see the bottom line price on the menu and they stay away. So from a business standpoint, it's the idea of eliminating tipping and including that as part of a fairer wage is something that most restaurateurs don't like. Servers don't like, and customers are clamoring for. So we have the stalemate of the current system.
And plus, it got even worse because now tips are not taxable, right?
That's exactly right. So the idea of your take-home pay being when the amount that's coming from tips, that's no longer touched. So even more so for the servers to resist that. So what we have is kind of a messy system. There are some restaurants scattered across the country that have tried. One, in fact, a very popular restaurant called Per Se in New York that tried it. And they tried it for just a brief while. And there was so much pushback, they actually lost staff because they found that their earnings were dropping significantly. They weren't interested. They wanted to work for a restaurant where they could earn tips. But, you know, it's unfortunate that we can't all get on the same page and just have transparency in pricing. It's certainly what consumers wish they had. And we're seeing this not even just in restaurants, but we're seeing this in retail establishments where you're going in to buy clothing. And so I don't know if that's happening very much in New Orleans yet, but if it's not, you will be seeing it. Certainly at concerts, you see it where you go to buy, you know, a concert T-shirt or a concert hat, where those concessionaires will flip that screen around with the option to tip. Now, what consumers have to remember there is tips in those scenarios are discretionary. If you feel you've gotten great service and you're feeling particularly generous and flush that week and you'd like to give a tip, of course, no one's going to say no. But if you tip either a custom tip that's smaller or nothing at all, you're well within your rights. Because although this is something that's kind of come into our worldview the last couple of years since the pandemic, it is by no means obligatory according to the rules of etiquette.
But it does make it awkward when that screen gets flipped toward you and it's kind of like, well, so did I do a good job? Are you going to pat me on the head? Are you going to reward me with a couple of bucks? And you say no, and then you turn around the other way, and then you wonder, well, am I going to really get what I'm supposed to get in my whatever it is I'm getting?
Yes. And the issue with a lot of this, you know, the larger context of this conversation we're having, Tommy, is that there's a de-incentive if you're working for an establishment where perhaps they don't tip in a retail location, for example, or where tips are pooled in a restaurant and you're not actually getting the servers feel like, well, if that's the case, then, you know, why should I put any extra effort? And I do think, the idea that you're working in hospitality and delivering anything but putting your best foot forward in those interactions, regardless of whether the tip is going to be 5, 10, 15, 25, or 30%, I think you should still be serviced with a smile, do your best. And then as customers, I think we should reward that when we see the good, above and beyond service. But to hold back or to, you know, take it out on a customer who didn't give us a good tip or didn't, you're spitting in their food or you're leaving something deliberately out of their order. That's obviously someone who has that mindset should not be working in hospitality.
Doesn't seem fair because the percentage of the bill is going to be a lot higher at a fancier restaurant than it will at a cheaper restaurant. And that goes to equity there as well, right?
That is true. And I think we see that especially, Tommy, is with alcohol. You know, you might at Commander's Palace, perhaps you're ordering a $300 bottle of wine. That's not happening at Chili's. And yet that $300 bottle of wine, you're tipping on top of that alcohol purchase too, which is significant. And when you think about it, is the action of opening a $300 bottle of wine that much different for the sommelier or for the server than it is to open a $40 bottle of wine? Not very much different. And yet the tip is going to be reflecting the larger cost. So you're right. I think if you're going to a fast casual place and you see the servers are really hustling and doing their thing just because you're getting a less expensive meal, I think if you have the means, I think it's a really wonderful thing to be able to tip extra generously for them, because they may be hustling even harder than the fine folks who are working in a spot like Commander's Palace.
And the other thing I hate, Thomas, is that you don't know whose fault is what. So you don't want to punish them for something they didn't do. And even the word punish strikes me wrong, because I don't want to I'm out to have a good time. I'm not out there to supervise the staff or have an employee meeting or decide who gets a raise and who doesn't.
That is very true. You know, a restaurant is an ecosystem, and there are a whole lot of members of that ecosystem who are hopefully collaborating in unison to make your experience a wonderful one. But if you don't like the taste of your meal, or if it's not cooked to your liking, that is most likely nothing to do with the server. That is something, a failure that happened in the kitchen. And to penalize a server for it. Now, if your server is outright rude to you, outright care, careless and forgetful.
What about missing an action?
On you. But if you feel like you're you know, sitting for 45 minutes and nobody's even approached you with a menu, that's a concern. And it may not be something that you should be taking up with the server directly because they're obviously swamped, but I would absolutely take it up with the manager. You need to. So, yes, your question about babysitting, do you need to babysit the staff? I think if your experience is anything less than what you're expecting, dramatically so, you should be speaking with the general manager that day in a polite way, in an understanding way, but you need to have your concerns voiced.
Thank you for listening to On Deadline, your radio news from Odyssey. On Deadline is written and produced by me, Christy Strasser, and by Lauren Barry. Subscribe wherever you get podcasts.